The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to today's MadTech Podcast. I'm John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire, and to digest this week's headlines, I'm joined by ExchangeWire's research lead, Matt Broughton. Matt, welcome.
Hi John, good to be here.
You're always welcome. Our special guest this week is Annalee Bridgestock, Executive Director of Data and Product at social media agency Jungle Creations. Annalee, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me today.
No, great to have you, and thank you very much for coming into our HQ. It's lovely to have a live podcast recording. Cool, let's crack on with our stories. And first, Netflix is looking to lay the smackdown on the streaming market after striking a decade-long deal with World Wrestling Entertainment. From January 2025, WWE Raw will be exclusive to the streaming giant in the UK, US, Canada and Latin America, and the deal will see Netflix pay in excess of $5 billion to air the show for a decade. Matt, is this a match made in heaven?
Yes, I can smell what Reed Hastings is cooking and I believe it to be good. I think it's an extremely strong move by Netflix. Obviously, you know, the billions of dollars outlay seems, you know, very strong at first glance, but then 500 million a year over a decade, it's small fry compared to their total content outlay, which is around $17 billion. And it allows it to dip its toes into the live sports broadcasting market without really having to bet the shed. We've seen the likes of Google and YouTube spending $14 billion over 7 years just to get the Sunday ticket deals for NFL, and that's just over 7 years. So this seems comparatively cheap for, you know, what is a weekly passionate audience. And Netflix has seen great success already in terms of that narrative-driven sports content with the likes of Drive to Survive, the Six Nations documentary that's currently ongoing in terms of the rugby. And what's more narrative-driven than WWE? I think it's a very, very shrewd move.
Yeah, like you say, it's, you know, this is sports has soap opera or soap opera sport, depending which way you look at it. And it couldn't be, it seems like a perfect partnership. Annalee, do you think can this move the dial in the streaming market? Is this a good deal for Netflix?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. I think the Bank of America actually said this week that it is clear now that Netflix is the winner in this race. That is a big comment and a big statement. However, if you look at what they've decided to do, per your point, they have chosen content, sport, and with really, really strong narrative and content. So actually what they've unlocked here is 40 years of drama, narrative, storytelling. And when you actually look at other live sport, you know, it's usually a kind of, let's go watch that match and turn it off again. You're now getting people who have got nostalgia from when they grew up. They kind of want to know the backstory. It's like, you know, the days of our lives of sport, if you will. And they unlock all that history in that catalogue, which is absolutely incredible. I think the other thing to point out is that currently Netflix's kind of programming slate is more geared in America, especially to the coastal kind of areas. And I think more to the kind of, I guess, higher affluence kind of market. And this is a really clever play to hit more states, more people across America. I think it really diversifies their programming and will really attract more people.
Yeah, I mean, that's a brilliant point in terms of Netflix's play here. WWE has a vast audience across a lot of demographics. I once saw Stephanie McMahon, one-time CEO of WWE, giving a presentation talking about their social media engagement in particular, and Netflix is now tapping into that. I think WWE has one of the most watched YouTube channels of any brand in the world. So do you think this is going to help really unlock those audiences and bring Netflix's name to a new variety of audience?
Yes, definitely. I think as well, it's actually apparently number 1, 2, and 3 on the ratings every Monday night. So, you know, it's a significant chunk of that. Apparently if football's on, it might not be number 1, 2, and 3, but it's going to bring a huge amount of new audiences. And I think as well, in the actual agreement, it's saying that the current agreement is LATAM, Canada, and the US, but actually more, it says specifically, you can add more markets to this. And really interesting, there are a lot of fans of WWE Raw around the world. So the UK is actually a big market for it. India and the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, really into WWE. So this is just unlocking an amazing amount of opportunity. And actually in America, there are more people subscribed to Prime Video than Netflix. So I was thinking, how much room is there to grow from a subscription perspective? But actually there is still room to grow, even though they've, you know, surpassed everyone globally.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, it seems like a no-brainer when you put it like that. It's an amazing deal. I think it's already done amazing things for the company's share prices. Matt, is this for you? Does this shift the dial in the streaming wars? Are Netflix a champion?
So yeah, I think in terms of the approach they've taken, it's very, very strong. Like I say, they've kind of got that balance between not overspending on sports content, as we're seeing a lot of the traditional sports broadcasters. They're locked into these massive, massive rights deals. Obviously in the UK, we see it in terms of the Premier League football. Every kind of rights deal, it's record billions spent. And that can sometimes lead to either, you know, higher ad loads for the user, or in terms of other content within that portfolio, that has to suffer and there's less spending on that. Whereas if they've got that kind of balanced approach, which I believe that Netflix has, it's, yeah, I think it's really, really strong currently.
Yeah. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about the audiences, but also with Netflix's new ad offering, is this like a world of new brands who are going to be looking at Netflix as a really viable advertiser if they can place their product next to WWE Raw?
Yeah, definitely. I was looking into this and I was trying to understand the current makeup of their revenue. And obviously, it's almost 100% subscriber revenue at the moment. They do anticipate advertising revenue to go up to $1 billion. That's still a tiny drop in the ocean compared to subscriber revenue. But then I did do the maths on the amount they're investing in WWE. And I was thinking, how many new subscribers would they have to get to actually cover that cost? That number is astronomical. I don't know if they're going to hit it via that. But to your point, new ad revenue, there's also other things that I kind of alluded to in all this kind of report. There's new merch deals, there's live events, there's actually sponsorship of the series itself, or like different bits of the kind of broadcast. There's also currently a lot around pay-per-view on the other channels, but actually, is this now an in-app purchasing thing on Netflix that comes out of that? They've also talked about a documentary. So I think there's multiple new revenue streams that are being unlocked from this partnership, which is, I think, the beginning of an entirely new streaming ecosystem and advertising ecosystem that we've never seen before.
Yeah, it's. I think it's a brilliant story. It's, you know, on the surface, it's Netflix gets into wrestling, and then you look at what WWE really is, its reach, the possibilities, the partnerships, the collaborations. It's it's a big move. And yeah, sets them on a pretty good footing from the start of next year. Matt, anything else on that?
No, just kind of add on that point in terms of the content that Netflix can generate out of it. Obviously they've got a very, very fledgling business within the gaming industry at the moment. And I remember as a kid, I never really used to watch WWE, but I had the game. I used to love hitting my older brother over the chair, metaphorically speaking, through the game. But yeah, this gives them another opportunity in terms of that. And also, I really wouldn't be surprised to see them go for the other TKO property of UFC if this, and within that first sort of 3 to 5 years, turns out to be a successful partnership. And again, that raises, you know, really interesting implications in terms of that pay-per-view piece as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's lots of narrative-driven content there as well in terms of the Ultimate Fighter sort of sub-tier that the UFC has as well. So yeah, it's a really interesting one.
I think on UFC, actually, it's the number one most pirated stream in the UK. So it's one of those interesting plays that if they do take something on like that, you then suddenly do swap potentially audiences who are pirating over here with the Fire Stick or whatever and actually going straight onto Netflix to watch it. So it's a really interesting play. And then there's also one more thing that I wanted to talk about with this is I think this is the beginning of sports broadcast rights changing, because a lot of sports around the world actually don't get airtime because, you know, kind of free-to-air channels maybe can't afford the rights or they just don't have them on there. So swimming, you know, tennis, like different levels of leagues don't get airtime, and therefore actually sports people don't get paid properly. So actually having bigger and different players able to bid for these rights means more sport to audiences, more sports for people, and actually more money for those sports people as well. So I think it's a really amazing shift in broadcast rights for sport.
Yeah, that's a like fascinating point as well. And obviously WWE as a testing ground for sports or as sports entertainment It's ideal for Netflix because there is no off season. It goes all year round. There is no off season. It's scripted, so the drama can be, you know, they can really market around it as well. But like you say, as a test for Netflix honing their sport marketing plan and getting more sports involved, I really like the idea of, you know, the more niche sports getting their rights on the streaming platforms, and particularly Netflix. That could be a really nice way to see the sports, digital sports marketplace evolving. Exciting stuff.
Yeah, really exciting.
Well, yeah, like I say, there's a lot more to get into than just Netflix getting into wrestling. It's a fascinating story that's, I'm looking forward to seeing what they do with it next year. We'll move on now to one of Netflix's rival, Prime Videos. They have revealed their pitch deck, revealing their sponsorship models. They've gone for preferred deal, guaranteed buy, and premium. Preferred deal is the most economical option with Prime, with a base CPM of $26. It allows advertisers to harness the tech giant's vast audience data for precise targeting. Annalie, where do you think the value lies in this range of options? And is Prime still attractive for advertisers?
I think this is so exciting. When I saw this topic come out, I was like, wow. First of all, it's a really volatile market at the moment in the media industry. And I think having to plan and deal with varying CPMs across all the platforms is quite tricky. And I think coming in at a bolshy, $26 CPM, when Netflix, Disney had doubled that, even YouTube can be up to, $40. Huge bolshy play. And I think from a value perspective, this is absolutely incredible because what they're bringing is content and e-commerce as a basic standard. So what that really means is, number one, you've got shopper data. So let me retarget people who have shopped for a brand, parts, whatever that might be. Number two, you've then got search intent. So let me then advertise to people who are searching for my category, my product, but not then buying. Number three is viewership data. So I've viewed something, I've watched something, I've got interest in something, let's target them. And the fourth bit, which for me is just like the golden ticket, is you are directly able to attribute that my campaign drove sales. And that's just an end-to-end planner's dream in my view.
It's, we've just talked about people saying that Netflix have just won the streaming wars with their WWE deal. And now Prime Video, you've just summed up the proposition in three neat sentences, really, about why they could also win the streaming wars. Matt, how do you see this and the value there for advertisers?
Yeah, just to completely reinforce your points, like in terms of what advertisers are looking for in the current market, they're looking for scale and quality. And I think this offers both that in terms of their subscriber numbers. Obviously, they've got a massive subscriber base, so that offers that scale. And in terms of that quality, they're getting, even on that mid-tier, they're getting audience lifestyle attributes, data as to whether the user is in a market for a particular product. And we've seen the likes, sectors, retail media and CTV, going up and up and up in terms of, advertiser thought process. And this kind of marries the two together in a really nice economical way. And I think as well, the fact they're offering third party measurement, that's also really encouraging, as it's, there won't be the standard accusations of marking your own homework. It's right there straight off the bat. And I think relative to how Netflix rolled out their ad offering, at least initially, I think this seems much more of a fleshed out product.
Yeah, it seems to be all encompassing, and they're using every arm of what distinguishes Amazon, I suppose, from the rest of the market for this proposition. There have been questions around Prime Video as to whether it's just an addition to get people to sign up to Prime, or whether it's whether you sign up for the video or for your delivery and then get the video as an extra, and whether there is enough quality on the Prime Video shows to attract advertisers and the viewerships there. Annalie, would Prime be your first stop if you were, when you're planning campaigns?
I think there's a difference between first stop for a consumer and first stop for a planner. As a consumer, even looking at YouGov, it's, 10 percentage points less in terms of quality, value for money, that type of thing. So you can't forget that. And I think it is an important thing to remember. But I do think that it actually has, I think, three or four times more content than Netflix does in the US, for example. So it hits all the right sort of levers for reach, scale, time spent. Could the perceived quality be higher? Potentially, yes. And I think they are looking at that a lot. You know, they've obviously taken on Thursday Night Football, which is, you know, kind of perfect in terms of brand advertising with a DR element in that. They've also then said for this particular pitch deck that the ads will be within the new Lord of the Rings franchise and that type of thing. So they've kind of pitched it with great quality Amazon original content. So I think they're going to be taking this really seriously. And I think to the point about Netflix being the winner, I did have a question. I was like, they are the winner of content for people, but from an advertising perspective, they're really missing that final bottom of the funnel bit. So I think Prime Video will be very careful with the type of advertising, the type of content that they put against this, because this is a really nice solution. So hopefully they get that right.
Yeah, Matt, do you think the quality's there?
Yeah, I think it is there. I think the one piece that Prime Video has missing compared to Netflix is that discoverability. Like you said, there's so much content out there, but if you go onto the platform, it's just a much more messy experience compared to Netflix. I can sign on to Netflix, browse through, I see exactly the type of show it is just off that first glance. On Prime Video, if I know something's there and I want to watch it, I'll search for it and watch it. But in terms of that kind of lazy, I don't really know what to watch, I can't really be bothered, it's Sunday, I'm quite tired, Netflix is my go-to rather than Prime Video, at least personally. So I think if they improve that discoverability piece, I reckon they could be onto a real winner.
And do you know, on your point, you originally mentioned, is this an opener for other bits of the ecosystem? And I think 100%, like, this is not where they see all their ad, you know, all the revenue coming from. This is opening the rest of their ecosystem. So I think it's something like 90% of Prime Video viewers are current Amazon shoppers. Like, they are pushing people within their ecosystem, around their ecosystem, and it's a bigger sort of revenue play from a shoppability point of view as well. So I think that's a really smart move.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to, you know, there's loads of questions about where this could go in terms of shoppable ads, like how this will be harnessed with social platforms. And yeah, again, you know, it's not an automatic win for Netflix. There's challenges here to them, despite the deal with WWE, but all very exciting for the TV market. In your work at Jungle, what's going on in TV for you? How do you talk about TV?
We think that TV, you know, has a really important role to play for really big above the line campaigns. But I think brands and businesses need to be really aware of the relationship between, you know, TV and social. So we talk a lot about communities and community engagement. It's not about managing a community. It's not about being a social media manager. It's about really enhancing and harnessing the growth of communities. We see a really different play between what social can do versus TV. So, you know, we've got really amazing DR campaigns running across social at the moment for a big travel company. We run the communities for some really, really huge brands around the world as well. And we see huge responses from a sales and revenue and, you know, brand perspective. So we're looking at really how the synergies and how you can play best between channels, between TV and social.
Yeah, I mean, it's natural partners, I imagine, TV and community.
Yeah, definitely.
Really interesting stuff. We will keep you posted all year on the streaming wars as they develop, as this Royal Rumble continues between Netflix and Prime. Final story. I feel like we should have a section for legal stories this year. We've been seemingly talking about them weekly. And this week, the Federal Trade Commission has launched an inquiry into investments and partnerships made by the biggest players in the generative AI landscape. Google's parent company Alphabet, Amazon, Anthropic, Microsoft, and OpenAI are all being investigated over tech giants' investment in the AI companies and whether the deals undermine fair competition. The AI landscape, it's the hottest topic probably in the industry, if not the whole world at the moment, but it is an intricate web. Anna Lee, do you think this FTC investigation could really help untangle this? How far down the rabbit hole do we go with this legal standing?
I think it's a really important kind of request for information. I think it needs to be done. This is a huge web. Like, the more you look into it, the more entangled it is. And I'm actually really glad that this has happened. I think there's a lot of question around whether it stifles innovation, but I don't think it does. I actually think it enables competition and choice and protects the people who are the ultimate end customer for these. But there is so much in here that we could untangle. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, you look at the points of the case, and it's, you know, you're deeper and deeper into how everything's interconnected, really. Matt, how do you Yeah, how do you see this FTC move, and is this important at the kind of nascent period of generative AI to get this really nailed down?
Yeah, it's so, so important. And I think we've seen regulators across both sides of the Atlantic taking a much dimmer view of monopolization. Obviously, you had the UK regulator throwing a real spanner in the works, at least temporarily, for the Microsoft Activision Blizzard acquisition. And I think, you know, initially you think, oh, is it a case of the regulators are now looking into it after the horse has bolted? But relatively, they've come to the table a lot quicker than they have previously. Look at the investigations that are going on at the moment in our space in terms of, you know, looking into Google and the DoubleClick acquisition. It's been decades since that acquisition, whereas now, you know, regulators are at least much more quick on the uptake. And we've seen obviously recently with the Sam Altman OpenAI, how much influence Microsoft has had in that case. So it's clear that they're not just backseat benevolent partners here, just giving money and seeing how it develops. They are actively looking into the development of these AI products, obviously for their own gain. So it's only right that regulators should be taking a look at it.
I think on that point as well, you've mentioned the Sam Altman situation. I think when I was looking into this, it was like, big companies investing in great tech or great other companies is absolutely fine. That's how we actually thrive as innovators. I think, you know, OpenAI actually couldn't get off the ground until Microsoft did the investment, although the biggest investment back in 2019. But where it gets really tricky for me, especially, and I feel uncomfortable about, is, you know, prior to December 2023, Microsoft was listed or spoken about as a 49% owner. And then suddenly on the website, it changed. It went from a diagram where they were sort of on the board as an owner to a kind of dotted line situation, which was saying, actually, no, you're an investor only that actually benefits from our profits. That's a very different stance from a 49% owner. The second thing you mentioned is the influence. So actually, when Altman was ousted as CEO, they hid it from Microsoft because they knew they'd have a problem with it. Then 90% of the OpenAI staff threatened to leave to go to Microsoft, which is bizarre, allegedly. And then Microsoft offered Altman a role with their AI intelligence department and then asked them to be reinstated. And now he's back at OpenAI. Really strange. And then the third bit, which I feel uncomfortable about, and I'm sure this isn't unusual because you do see it with Google and Amazon and Anthropic as well. But, you know, Azure is the exclusive cloud partner for OpenAI, and that's part of the agreement. So it's a little bit of, it's just very, very entangled. And I just don't know how deep that goes.
They're all in bed with each other, it seems, when you put it like that.
I didn't want to say it, but, you know.
It's funny, yeah. It's, yeah, and this is what the FTC really need to get at, because like you say, you know, the shift in the terminology around Microsoft's involvement in OpenAI, the fact that it was almost seen as, you know, oh, well, if I can't work at OpenAI, I can go straight over to Microsoft, suggests that there's interlinking. We know there's interlinking between them, but in terms of, like, I want to talk to you a little bit about how you're seeing generative AI being used in creative and what your clients are asking for in a bit. But yeah, Matt, in terms of, you know, this, the growth we're seeing, you've already said, has the horse already bolted? But I think in terms of the trust in generative AI and the companies we're going to be using to help define our creative future and work landscape, like hashing it out at the beginning seems a good plan. Do you think that we're going to need that to reinforce public trust in these companies?
I think it's a little bit of column A and column B. I think, you know, users are going to be experimenting with these platforms, particularly in a professional context, seeing what works for them. Obviously, there's going to be data concerns. And I think as well, that's another key area of regulation. But similar to how, you know, we've seen lots of tech trends, I think, particularly since COVID, they've emerged at a much more rapid rate than they have previously and then settled down. You know, we've had the likes of Web3 and blockchain, just as an example. So I reckon that, you know, the hype in AI seems a lot more sustained in that. And in terms of the generative AI platforms, they are particularly impressive. But I think as well, at the moment, there's a case of, what can we do with them? We've kind of scratched the surface in terms of those generative AI platforms. It's that next step, I think, will be the key development. And I think, you know, the regulators getting in as they have done before that shift change, I think that's obviously a huge positive.
Yeah, and it's a big opportunity for Lena Khan as well, who's come into her job in 2021 and has been on the back foot with the tech regulation, which she's obviously very interested in and focused on. And this has been an opportunity for her to get involved from day one, basically, and kind of stop it before it goes too far if we're heading down that path. Do you think this is a good thing for the FTC to really be kind of taking a stand here, Annalie?
Yeah, I really do. I think I saw the other day there was a report that showed across the world the kind of trust in what's happening in the AI space, and also then the kind of how fast they feel it's progressing. And it was something like 60% of people on average across the world were just a bit nervous about how fast this is going and progressing. And I think because it is such an unknown, like, you know, we can't all speak that tech language. What's really happening under there? You know, last year it was reported that, you know, ChatGPT could actually go against its own rules and lie and break a recapture and say it wasn't a robot, you know, so is that the surface? So I think people are really nervous. So I think the more people who are, I guess, I was gonna say professional people looking into this and seeing, you know, that it is in the greater good of the people, will set some kind of trust around the issue. And it does make people kind of sleep at night potentially a bit easier.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, from the industry we cover, from the advertising industry, the creative industries, you know, we talk about this sometimes on the surface level of faux out of home, which has become like a big thing. These generative AI made campaigns that never existed in the real world, but look incredibly realistic. We talk about that eroding trust, chomping into ad spend particularly. But how are your clients asking you about it? And how are you, you know, in your role at the moment, how's generative AI really making an impact?
I think it's just transformed the way we kind of come up with ideas, we generate stories, it helps you. I think shortcut is not the right word because it sounds like you're kind of not doing the due diligence, but it helps you have more in your arsenal. You have more options, more ideas at a much quicker pace. I think it's kind of optimizing and kind of, I guess it makes better results, I think, because you're able to have almost more brains, but it's more computer brains. So I think it's an augmentation at the moment rather than a replacement, which is great. But, you know, I think this demand will continue more and more. I don't know if you saw, obviously, WPP announced their massive restructure of about 120 million. And then conversely, double that amount of investment in tech and AI. So, you know, this is something that we will keep seeing and continue to seeing. And again, all of that is in the space of talking about enhancing and giving better quality and better kind of effectiveness of content. So, we use it quite a lot, and it's just the beginning, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. Seeing the holding companies making big plays. We've had WPP and Publicis announce big AI plays this week. Mm. So yeah, obviously that we've seen the way the wind is blowing here. And like you say, at the moment, augmentation and a creative tool, I suppose, as much as anything.
Yeah, actually on that, we've actually just launched a fantastic new tool called Jungle IQ on brand. But essentially it's an AI powered content analytics platform. So what it actually does is it connects all of our 198 channels or something, all that publisher data. It actually uses AI to document what's in the first 60 seconds of every single frame in terms of brand, image, emotions. We're then able to marry that immediately in real time with performance and then actually use that on our agency side of the business, The Wild, to actually kind of infer understanding of what content works best, you know, what kind of formats work best, what emotions are being generated in real time. And that's just the beginning. I mean, imagine before AI, we'd be sitting there tagging it. So, you know, that's just a perfect example of how we've kind of been able to bring, I guess, our publisher-powered data to drive through to our agency.
That's really, really interesting. Like a really great case study for how it's being used. And yeah, you know, it's make friends with the machines before they take your job and learn how to use them first. This is always my favorite thing to say about this. Matt, yeah, anything to add on the AI landscape and particularly the more litigious side of it?
Yeah, I think it's obviously, you know, anything legal, anything government, it's going to rumble on. It's going to take time. But the fact they've got in at this stage, I think, you know, hats off to them for getting in so quickly. And yeah, I don't, you know, to Annalie's point earlier, I don't think it's going to hinder innovation. I think we're going to see people run and run with these platforms and see what they can do with them. But yeah, having a few, you know, checks and balances in there is no bad thing.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to call it a day there, but thank you both so much for joining me, Matt. As always, thank you.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Cheers, John.
And Annalie, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been really great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening. To read more about some of the subjects we've touched on today, you can still download ExchangeWire's Industry Review 2024 from www.exchangewire.com. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week.